He's such a sweet guy, Josh Fries. I was at Chuck and Barb's 50th anniversary at Bob Wackerman's house.
Oh, huh?
And I hear this, Ken. It's Josh, you know?
Yeah.
I couldn't believe he remembered me.
Yeah.
He was so kind, and he remembered so much. No matter he's so successful, he must be really good with people.
Oh, for sure.
Okay. And and the time I saw him previous was when Brooks and Jason Fries were in a show at Knott's Berry Farm.
Oh, fun.
I don't know if you remember that.
I didn't know that his brother played at Knott's.
Yeah, there was a, I can't remember the name of the band, but this was around the time of when Brooks was playing with Steve Vai.
Oh, okay.
Remember that with Danny Cooksey and I don't even remember that.
I don't even know if I knew Brooks played with Vai.
Yeah, they had a little band called Bad for Good, so it was,
oh, yeah. That's right. I forgot that? About that. I forgot about that. Yeah, I remember that now.
Remember Danny Cooksey and
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's the last time I saw Josh, and he at that time he was in some cover band. I can't remember the name of the cover band, but he had like a one of those little tiny ponytails in the back of his head. It was like 80s, back in the 80s. You know, late.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Funny.
So I don't really know him really well, but every time he sees me, he always makes a fuss.
Oh, that's
He's
great.
He's a really kind person.
Yeah, know? He is. He is. Yeah. Yeah, you can tell just by the way he celebrates other people on his social media and whatever, that like he's pretty... not a braggy guy, pretty humble guy, and just is really excited for other people to do well and
that's killer.
Celebrate other people. And I think that's a great, for someone who's so talented, that's a really good feature to have.
Yeah. And the other time I saw him is when I was a kid, I used to take, in that same garage we were just in, I used to take lessons from Roy Burns, who was this famous drummer.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and then... and at that, after I'd finished, maybe I was playing with you, I'm not sure, but then, you know, I would see Josh, because he began to take lessons with Roy.
Oh, he took from Roy, too.
Yeah, so I'd see him over at Aquarian, like, in one of the extra offices, you know, with the practice pad or drum set.
Right.
Or but, yeah, so this podcast is just about things that we think about regarding art. Lately, of course, the big thing on my mind's been AI. I've actually been playing around with it a little bit.
Yeah.
But I want to get more to you, you know, first. Like, you and I played in the band together.
Yeah.
And then you began to do other things. And you always had a good eye on, you know, finding your own voice and doing something that wasn't like this commercial cliche. Like, you seem to explore music more bravely than some others at that back in the 80s. Is that true or no?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, think about it. The 80s, I feel like I was just trying to figure out if I was a good musician or if I could even hang with people to play music. You know, if I look back on it, I don't know if I was thinking so much about finding a voice as much as, just trying to be competent enough to play with other people.
I was
so, I mean, I was obsessed with practicing and other musicians, almost to the point of being detrimental, because I think there's a point you can get to be like obsessive about other musicians and what they do and their little tricks and think about that rather than thinking, it's kind of like not seeing the forest through the woods, you know,
yes.
You lose sight of the fact that you're all playing music and trying to connect with people on an emotional level. And sometimes you just get lost in the technique or the gear or things like that. And I'm sure that I went through just a lot of that in those days, just trying to, just trying to be good enough to play with other people.
I've always thought you were just a fantastic musician. I mean, let's go back there a little bit. Like, what was your setup gear-wise when you were in that garage?
Oh, God.
I remember it was a Brown amp for some reason.
Yeah, I had... That was my first amp, the first real amp I got. It was a Marshall Country Combo, I think.
Wow, I bet that was loud.
It was loud. I think it was a 50-watt. But the funny thing is, for a short time, Marshall was trying to compete with Fender. Like, this must have only been a couple of years.
Okay.
And so they thought, we'll do a Brown Phase amp.
Oh, cool.
And at the time, really all I just wanted was a regular Marshall, but this came up on, I think I used to buy gear through the recycler.
Yep, we all did. So that was the internet back then.
Yeah, that was like Craigslist, but there was no photos or anything. You just had to.
True.
You
just had to. I forgot about those. Just words.
Yeah, it was just words. Oh. So you just had to kind of, you see the ad for there's Marshall, and it's within the price range I want.
Yeah.
It just says Marshall amp, 2 amp, 50 watts. I'm like, cool, I'm there. And so I remember it was like, I finally talked my parents into buying me an amp. And so we go out to, I don't know where the hell it was, somewhere where you never go. If you live here, like you never go to like Tarzana or West Covina or someplace like that. Like we never go there. You know,
us Orange County people, especially.
Yeah. Like it was somewhere like in Placenta or something. Like, I don't know. Placentia. It was some area we never. So we make our way out there. Like we had to use our Thomas Brothers guide to get the hell out there.
That was our map system. Yes.
And so by the time you get out there, there's no turning around. It's like I got my dad in the car. He's got $300 in his pocket. It's a Marshall, and I go and see this brown amp. I'm like, what the fuck is this?
Really?
He's like, well, it's a Marshall amp. I'm like, I've never seen a brown one before. And then it was only later that I learned it was like they were trying to compete with Fender or whatnot. And so I was like the only guy I ever met with a brown Marshall amp. And that's what I had then, was this brown Marshall amp. And it would get dirty. It would do the Marshall thing, but it was terribly unreliable. And I had that terrible old Plymouth Fury that I would put it in the back.
I remember that.
It was a stupid heavy amp and a stupid heavy car. And every time I drove that amp, it would rattle the hell out of it. And so the tubes would become dislodged. And so I had to carry extra tubes because they were always just getting rattled so much and falling out. And I would show up to rehearsal, my amp, I got to get another tube out of the car.
Whoa, I love that.
So that was my amp back then. And, you know, I didn't know any better. It was like I didn't have anybody giving me gear advice. It's not like now where you can just go on YouTube and get all this information. And
it's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just figured that's the way it is. This is just life with a good amplifier. Yeah, right. I didn't know it was a amplifier. Yeah.
I love that. You never told me that back then.
Yeah, well, I think I was a little bit embarrassed. I was like, or I just was like, well, this is just life with an amp. I don't know any better, you know.
I love that.
So, yeah, so I had that, and then my dad and I built a pedal board. I don't know if you remember the giant pedal board that I had that we had built.
Oh, yeah. And he helped you?
Yeah, he helped me.
Where'd you guys? How did you construct that?
Just like plywood, and then we got some vinyl to cover it. You know, my dad was really into refinishing furniture, like recycling furniture, and he would always reupholster the furniture in our house when it got old.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's killer that he liked to do that. You lucked out.
Yeah. And he went one day helped me with that. So we built that pedal board, and so I had 5 or 6 pedals on it, and Velcro.
Right.
All that sort of thing. And I think that was my setup, that and the Les Paul, which I still have.
You do?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's sweet. Does that thing sound better today than it did then because the wood, the resin in the wood hardened, or is that just a myth about old wood?
I haven't ever compared it to a current Les Paul. Mm-hmm. I have older Strats too, not like super collectible ones, but I have a Fender jazz bass a Fender P bass from the 70s.
That's a nice
artifact. It's beautiful, yeah. It's a beautiful sounding instrument. Yeah. And that's not even like the wonderful period of Fender. Like this is post CBS. Okay. So it's still super heavy and just plays great. And I think you'd be hard pressed to find a Fender, a brand new like American Fender, that sounds as good as that one does.
Right.
I think that, I don't know if it's the density or, I think it has to do with maybe the quality of wood that was being used.
That's a good point.
You know, in the 70s and 80s and 60s and 50s for sure.
That's a good point. I mean, it's agriculture in a sense, right? I mean,
yeah. And then they started putting limitations on the kind of wood. And then wood started getting really, really expensive by the 90s, I think. And
other things that change is laws about what kind of glue they're allowed to use.
Glue
and then that happened, you know.
Oh yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, and then some wood was just completely outlawed, like for a while where you couldn't get rosewood.
Too scarce.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So wood would come off and on the scarcity, exotic wood lists, and so back then I think the wood was better quality, like because it was, you know, you didn't have to price out a bunch of different types of species of wood. Right. So I don't know. I think that might have something to do with it, but I don't know if the aging affects it that much. It certainly affects the color. Like all the bands on that Les Paul that used to be whiter, like this cream yellow mm-hmm, color at mm-hmm. this point, you know.
Just maybe oxidation or something.
Yeah. Right.
Wow.
But it's a quality instrument. I mean,
yeah.
I'm still happy I have that.
And so, you know, we did that thing, and then you went on and you did compilation records with like the Residents and
right.
I remember you liked Holdsworth.
Oh God, yeah, that was high school and mm-hmm. yeah, and just after I went to that whole kind of fusion
mm-hmm.
era, you know, Jeff Beck, Wired era, Holdsworth, mm-hmm. Return to Forever, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So the whole fusion deal.
Yeah.
And then where did at that time were you listening to more eclectic music, or did it lead to that? Like, when did you start getting into things that were less you know, refined and, you know, like we were just talking about the skateboard or the photography, like you have all these different types of art, you know? And
right.
Were you always into all types of art, or was it something that evolved?
Yeah, it definitely evolved. It's sort of this rabbit hole discovery process that you kind of go through. I remember, when John and I were in that band, which was right after I got out of high school.
Oh, Biggie?
Yeah. It's funny, given John's background, but that band kind of had this anti-jazz fusion kind of vibe about it. Like, we were like, we're not going to be those guys who play a million notes. And
it's
a little bit more of a punk rock attitude.
That's cool.
But still, everything sounded like, I mean, we had a stick player in the band, for fuck's sakes. I mean, it was still going to be, it was still going to be notey and a little bit on the prog side of rock.
So. And it was.
Yeah.
I went to a few of those shows. It was really amazing. Yeah, I mean, it was another level of, because I played with you, you know.
Yeah.
To hear you making music like that, it became this other, like a new fusion in a sense. Or I don't know exactly how to explain it, but it was. Yeah.
Well, a lot of that, I think, had to do with John, because he was doing such an innovative kind of...
The drumming.
His setup, I mean, you know, everyone flipped out when they saw his drum kit. Remember when he had the Simmons and the Toms up above him and all that?
Yeah. He still does that sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how that old man gets his arms.
But that was some crazy stuff, and I think that may have influenced that band more than anything, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I look back and think about it, you know, like the guy who was kind of leading it, this guy Gene, he had some general ideas, but if I really think about it, I think John probably influenced that, the attitude and the direction of that band more than anything, you know.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Can a drummer can do that? A drummer can really influence the style of a thing.
Totally. Look at Zeppelin. I mean.
Yeah.
I was reading somewhere about the theory going into recording Zeppelin, and Page was always adamant that the drums need to sound as big as Bonham is. Like,
that's interesting.
That's the first thing we have to do. That's the first thing we have to get right.
Everything else is, my God.
Yeah, everything else is completely sidelined. If we don't get the drum sound right, we may as well give up.
Wow.
And so they just focused.
They knew that.
Yeah, they knew that. Because
he
was such an influential part of that band. Like, we got to get Bonzo sound.
Wow.
And that's why they would go places like Headley Grange and record in that house with putting the mics up on the landing above them and get that big booming sound.
Get that room.
Yeah. Or you think about like when the levee breaks, they were putting that through like a big delay, even the kick drum, just to get like this thick, big sound. And I think John was kind of like that for that band. I mean, it kind of seemed like we were, at the time, the kids in the band, and we were just kind of brought on as, and we weren't hired guns because we weren't getting paid, but it was just kind of like, well, yeah, you guys can be in the band too. But thinking back on it, it seems like...
You guys are the talent, though.
I think John definitely...
Because you used to play these amazing guitar solos, and then you guys had all kinds of like... things you do on stage.
Oh, we did some funny shit on stage. Yeah, yeah, there was definitely some Zappa influence there for sure. Yeah,
I mean, it's not the kind of thing you'd see at these grimy little clubs in Huntington Beach normally. Normally it was like punk rock or something like that, you know. It was very sophisticated. I mean, it was a great breath of fresh air, I felt.
I think very few people realize that. I mean, I seem to always just be doing some kind of music that no one is, like, so there's a few people that are like, oh, I get that. But at that time, there was like this cross between this kind of new wave band, like kind of, there was a missing persons element to it.
Yes.
And then there was the
first
Zappa influence
to it.
The EP
they did. I can see that, yeah.
And
your tempos were pretty heart racing, and it wasn't just intricacy for intricacy's sake. I felt that stuff felt good.
Yeah.
Oh, is that stuff recorded anywhere?
I know we recorded one or two pieces. I have no idea where those recordings would be, though. I think I probably have a cassette tape someplace.
Wow, how killer. Yeah, it'd be killer to hear that.
Maybe. Yeah, I know we did go into the studio a few times.
Maybe someday that'll emerge on YouTube.
It could. I remember, you know, John sounded great on that stuff. And there's some stuff that I don't know. It probably sounds really dated. I was using a lot of whammy bar in those days, and probably sounds...
Well, it is what it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I never knew this about you. So do you have are you rough on yourself when you listen to your music?
I'm better now. Although if I listen to something I did 5 or 6 years ago, I'll be like, how did I let that go? But in a way, that's good because it's showing.
You're keeping a certain level of efficiency by doing it that way, or?
I think it's.
You're trying to progress. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I think it's the idea of seeing that you're evolving, that you're making progress, that your ears are improving. That, for me, a lot of it is just, at least now when I think look back on things, it's not so much compositionally. Usually, the compositions or performance, I'm usually okay with. Although there are now some real niggly performance things that I look back on and think, well, I would have improved that. But it's more of the production side and mix side that I look at now and think about. Because I feel that at this point, that's where I'm really focusing a lot of my area of improve. You know, like really, mixing is pretty fascinating to me. And
It's a fucking dark art.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, even with all the information we're talking about on the web, and it's still not a thing I've really seen clearly represented. Do this.
Oh yeah.
You know, like it's. You can push volume up and down, but there's way more to it than that.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I mean, if you go and watch, there's that one mix engineer, Dave. He does the Into the Layer.
Oh yeah, I love that guy.
You know the guy?
Oh, I love that.
Forgetting
guy.
His last name.
Yeah.
You can go and watch all his stuff and still not know what the hell to do.
No.
I mean, he'll maybe instantiate a couple plugins, and they're so incredibly subtle.
Right. He's on, it's off.
I know.
It's a world of difference. On, exactly. Off. And you're all, wait, what?
Yeah, exactly. Pensato, that's his name.
Pensato, yeah. I love that guy.
Yeah, he's really fun to watch, but I can see people just watching a lot of those and talking about it, and then still not knowing the first thing to do if you get a mix put in front of you and trying to get it to sound right. Like, there's no substitute for the 10,000 hours, right, that people talk about. You know, and then if you're in this kind of business or this kind of career path that I've gone on, it's like, well, I put in easily the 10,000 hours on just playing an instrument. But now it's like the 10,000 hours extra I got to put on composing, and then the 10,000 hours I got to add to producing and mixing. It's like it's never ending.
You know? Yeah, yeah. I think I'm not an expert mixer, but I've just always had to do it because nobody would want to do my music. And the thing I learned recently that really helped me was one of our biggest, I think, obstacles is the GUI. You know, because you look at that computer. And you're on your, some delay unit or whatever, and you're maybe playing with saturation. Well, I have it on a 1. It does to a 9. And then what I heard from maybe it was the layer guy, you know, like, don't even look.
Yeah.
Just like grab the mouse and just,
yeah.
You know, and does it sound different? You know, because boy, you can really look at stuff and like, oh, I'm going to go and I'm going to low pass everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, sometimes that's a good thing, but how about every time you low pass you listen?
Yeah, right.
You know, and all that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, when I was first starting to do any kind of mixing at all, I didn't, I mean, this is someone, you know, I started on analog boards and working that way, but then I kind of didn't do it for a long time, didn't mix anything on analog or anything anywhere. I would have other people do it, and then got back into it on computer. And for the longest time, if I didn't have like a equalizer that showed me the current sound wave as it was playing, and then could make
analyzer.
Yeah, like the channel EQ in Logic will do that. It will show you what your track looks like as you're adjusting your curves. If I didn't have that to reference visually, I would have a hard time, you know, in the mix. Now I'm relying on my ears more, and I think that's where you turn the corner.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
When you
can, it lead you astray, the analyzer.
Sure, it's easy to get caught up in that because you'll, you know, maybe you heard Dave Pensado say, you know, if you've got too much energy at, you know, 2K, you know, your mix is going to suffer, and so you like that gets stuck in your head.
Mm-hmm.
But then maybe you realize, oh, well, all the energy from this guitar part is at 2K. If I take that down,
right,
we lose the energy of the whole song. So, yeah, it's just a maturity that I think you develop after doing it a lot,
right.
And you just have to be confident with it. That's the hardest part: getting confident. Getting confident with your decisions and just going, yeah, I'm good with that decision.
My strategy is I just make really lousy shit, and slowly it just becomes less lousy.
The polishing the turd.
Yeah, but I'm not afraid to like just fuck it up and just go in there just.
That's good. That's a good. Right. I mean, in a way, I think if you can, I think that's a philosophy to help you, in all things creative. But if a mix, you can remember that. Okay. I'm just going to save a copy of this mix, this
True.
Session.
I do it all the time.
And now I'm just going to fuck with it.
Oh, yeah.
And then that gets you to a different place of being, as opposed to, okay, I've got to make this perfect, and I've got to deliver it to, maybe you're delivering it to a client or whatever. Like, that for some reason, you're going to be a lot more tense.
Mm-hmm.
If you can just do a, well, fuck it, I'll throw everything at the wall and see what happens mix. And then that might get you to a new place. You know, it's just that creative process
play,
you have to allow yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you make stuff, you mix stuff, and then do you listen to it to the next day and ever think, oh my God, what the fuck was I thinking?
Oh yeah, all the time. I have a rule that if I'm doing any kind of work for a client and I do a mix at night, I do not send that out at night.
Right. You don't immediately.
Perfect, send. <Yeah. laughs> That never happens.
So that's the thing we do in photography, you know, like there's a thing about being distant from the thing, right? Being absent from it, you know. You get some fresh eyes or mixing, be fresh ears.
Absolutely.
Same with composition too, right?
Really. Totally.
Because you're on it. You can easily become too close to a thing.
Oh yeah, you kind of eventually build that into the process, which is kind of that maturity that goes along with it. You know, I'll like this week I was doing some music for a client, and I wrote a couple of the pieces, and then just finished for the day. I knew I wasn't going to get any further. At a certain point, you kind of, part of that maturity, you realize when you're useless. And so you think, okay, well, maybe I will be useful again in 3 hours, but for now, I'm just going to stop.
Right.
And then the next morning, then I'll go and listen to it with fresh ears. And it's often the case, I was like, what the hell was I thinking? Or where's the focus in this song? And then I make a few mix changes, like, oh, okay, that's the thing that needs to be forward. This thing that I had forward needs to be back here. Your brain has a way of like spilling this all out, and you just have to let it spill out.
Yes.
And then you put on another hat to come back and kind of refocus it and edit it.
That's killer.
There's a, I don't know if you've read that Rick Rubin book that's out now.
Oh no, I like
the Creative
Rick Rubin.
Act. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's he does a great job of kind of breaking down the creative process, which I totally resonate with. I read that, and I'm like, yeah, that's what it's like. That's it. You know, it's like almost yelling out loud. Like, yes, exactly. He puts that's names cool. to things. And like the first one he calls, you know, just collecting seeds, mm-hmm. where you're just kind of spitting anything out, mm-hmm. and you're just like, anything's an idea, and it could be valid, it might not be valid, but you just gotta
kind of word vomit the thing.
Yeah, totally. Uh-huh. And it might, you might plant it and something might come out of it, or mm-hmm. you know, it might not.
Throw it away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you just like, there's this whole process, and then the next process is editing those ideas, and kind of that's where the hard work is, and that's where I think a lot of people get stuck. It's right. like you get all these ideas out, and it's super fun to do that, but then you have to put on this hat of finding what works in those things.
Yes.
And that's harder. And that's where your craft really comes into play. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to get started in that phase, I find. But if you put a day or so into it, like I had this one piece, this song that I'm working on. I think writing a song is harder than just writing a piece of instrumental music for a game or something, like actually writing a song that
your
people
own
will
song.
Enjoy. Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Right.
And so I had all the seeds for that together, and I had this whole thing. Actually, John has helped me with it. I asked him to just do a bunch of drum beats for cool. me, and then I kind of edited them down, and I got this whole, it took me like a week to edit down all these little seeds of ideas that I had into something cohesive.
Cool.
But like I was saying, your brain spits this stuff out, and it kind of knows, like you'll start to see these patterns emerge as you're looking at what you spit out. And you're like, oh, this makes sense if I put it over here, if I turn this around. And like, it's kind of like starting to see the Matrix, to use a hackneyed metaphor. But yeah, it starts to be like, oh yeah, like, I can kind of see what my brain was doing there, what I was like. Your brain makes these connections and you're just not consciously aware of them. And I think you just got to get it out.
Right.
And then you start to see where the connections line up. Mm-hmm. If you spend some time in that editing kind of crafting process.
And on that particular piece you're talking about, where are you at with it now? Like how far days wise are you into it, you know, chronologically?
Oh, you mean how much time have I spent on it?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I'm not exactly sure. Because I don't think I really counted the how long I spent on just kind of collecting the different parts. I can tell you just the process though. So I, like one of the, speaking of Bonham, one of the prompts that I just gave to John was like, do a Bonham beat as if he was Brazilian. So get, I want a Brazilian influenced Bonham kind of feel. And the Bonham tune I used, the Zep tune I used was Poor Tom off that Coda album. It's got a very, right. you know, that
it's very Brazilian,
yeah.
drumming kind of.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's kind of got that feel. And there's an artist I've been listening to named Renata Rosa, who's not very well known here, but she's Brazilian. And she plays a different kind of this Brazilian folk music. There's a little bit more from Spain than Brazil. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I'm trying to get her to sing on the song. And so that was the impetus of like, okay, give me this Brazilian thing. And so I took that, and I cut up some little pieces of his thing. And then I came up with these, I have this idea to make it sort of a Zeppelin-esque Brazilian piece.
That's okay.
So, with acoustic guitars.
What a concept.
So it's all that, because I love that kind of acoustic Zeppelin that not that many people think about. I mean, they think about Stairway to Heaven, but did they think about, you know, that song Friends or Led Zeppelin 3 or some of the stuff from the acoustic stuff from Physical Graffiti, things like that.
No, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Music.
Yeah. Great stuff. I love that kind of grooving with acoustic guitars kind of. Yeah, I think that stuff's great. So I had this, and Renata's music, there's one piece on her Cantaciones, I think is the name of the album. It's a blue cover that's got a Zeppelin feel.
And I was really? Like,
what the hell is going on here?
That's
there's this kind of symbiotic, there's something happening here. So So I had this idea to try and do something like that. So it's been impossible to get a hold of her. I've tried through her booking agent. I've tried her through Instagram. I had a friend of mine translate it into Portuguese. Mm. I'm still trying to get a hold of her. So now I've got like a message into the recording studio. I know she worked out last week. Like, how do I get a hold of her?
Right.
So I'm trying to get a hold of her. But anyway, so I've put this at this point, the song is basically complete. I've got lyrics. I've got melody. I've got the whole arrangement and everything. And this will be part of the whole polyhedron project that I've been doing,
which is
just a collab. The whole idea is to do a collaborative thing with other musicians
and
bring other musicians' collaboration process. Because I have it all written, but Renata could do something if I get a hold of her and might have something that turns the whole thing upside down. And I may completely change that arrangement.
Sure, of course. It's all open.
Yeah.
The art should speak to what happens.
Right.
Yep.
But with that particular project, depending on who I'm going to collaborate with, for the most part, I try to give them as complete a thing as possible to contribute to, because I don't know how much time they want to invest in it.
Right.
If I can just say, here, you could just sing this for 2 or 3 hours and you'll be done. Or if you want to do more, you can.
Right.
When I gave that to Nels Klein for the last album, like, he did a ton of shit. He gave
That's
me
killer.
A bunch of stuff.
That's killer.
And so I had my version of that piece. And then he gave me so much stuff, I just did a whole remix version to include all of his...
That's awesome.
...his work in it, because he just did a lot of really great things.
And you don't have any control over how that's recorded, correct?
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He was collaborating with his wife. She was in that band. That's escaping me. The two-person band that was big in the 90s, two women from Japan. I like chicken. You got to love your chicken. Chibo Amato.
Yeah.
Chibo Amato.
Right. Cool thing about podcasts is if you don't remember a thing, you just text me later on.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's so in the links.
His wife... I helped him record it, and I think she edited it down. Mm. So in a way, she was a collaborator, though he didn't ask me to add her name to it. But I don't have any control on how they record it, you know. But that's okay. That's fine.
To bounce back to our beginnings, you know, we didn't have to be engineers when we were kids. We envisioned a life of just being a musician.
That's
not
right.
Having to fiddle with knobs. Now, like, I have some friends who are like some of the top studio drummers in the world, and they all are basically making it out of their garages.
They're just recording remotely?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and this is stuff that goes like to Disney and, I mean, big stuff.
Yeah, sure.
So what is it like to have to do that, to wear, because you talked about wearing hats before.
Yeah, yeah.
And it took me a long time. I don't know if I ever got used to being able to hit record and then go play and play as if I'm a musician just playing.
Yeah.
Because in my brain, I'm thinking about, oh, is it peaking out? Is it...
Sure.
You know, did the hard drive stutter?
Right.
Does that ever affect you at all, or did you get used to that pretty quickly?
I mean, it's a double-edged sword, because a lot of times I wish that I had... Like, when my daughter was younger, I used to just get her to hit record for me.
And you lost that worker, didn't you?
Yeah, I lost her, yeah. My son could do it, but he's too busy. Like, he's doing his own thing.
That's
so,
cool.
A lot of times I wish I just had somebody just hit record for me.
Do you think you'd play differently, or do you think not?
I think it's a time issue. I would get to where I want to be faster if someone else was doing it. I can get there, but it just takes a little longer because I'm a little sidetracked.
Right.
But you know, you can just set your DAW to just keep looping the part and just record every version that you
play. I do that.
Play. Yeah.
Love the take folders.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So you can do that, and it's possible, and that helps you just get in the zone a little bit easier. It would be nice to have someone else do it. But I say double-edged sword because I think had I been able to have this technology of a DAW and a computer, unlimited tracks, I would have been doing it a long time ago.
Yeah, true. Know?
Like, true. I would go back and I think about the records I did with Giant Ant Farm.
Akai MG 1214, right?
With Giant Ant Farm?
Yeah, wasn't that the recording, the Akai unit?
Oh, no, that, are you talking about the 12-track?
Yeah.
That was what we had at South Bay Sound in Gardena here.
Okay.
And they had two of those, but Giant Ant Farm was a little bit later, and then we recorded,
Giant Ant Farm, I'm sorry. Yeah. I recorded drums on one of those things for you.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Was that the first cassette we did?
Might have been. I have one of your cassettes in my shelf.
Oh, funny.
Yeah.
I know we did some recording with a guy that did play drums there with us for a while, Anthony Arvizu. Do you know Anthony?
I don't know him, but I think I played something after that because either he couldn't come do it
or
in between drums or something. I remember playing some song.
Okay. Oh, gosh.
Kind of an up-tempo thing.
Better memory than me. But I remember when we recorded that stuff, like, so we did a couple different cassettes, and then we did a full-length CD, and then another, like, EP after that. And I just remember being so frustrated that the production never turned out the way I wanted it.
Your vision.
And had I had access to what I have now, I would have been able to do that. And I just wish that I had access to that at those times, you know, because it was... You'd have limited time in the studio because we didn't have any money, and so you just
that
have
changes
to,
the product.
Yeah, it really does.
Right.
And you know, you've been in this band, and we've all been playing the songs forever. So in theory, it should be perfect, right? You should be able to just go in and get the right feel with the people that you've been playing this music with, and in a sense, that gets you part of the way there. But then I had all these other ideas about what to do with production. Mm. I think I've always had that producer. Sense that I, you know, that aesthetic that I wanted to get someplace different with it. And to me, it's like, well, the songs are kind of represented, but in a very bare bones, skeletal kind of way. Like they're not fleshed out the way I always imagined them, you know?
Right.
While it is a bit of a burden, I think it's better to have those chops to be able to learn how to do that stuff to see your vision through, if you're that kind of person.
Yeah.
Not everyone is that kind of person.
True.
Yeah.
So for you, you're happy that it happened.
Yeah. I mean, just going down that rabbit hole of virtual instruments and then adding that on top of, you know, in the box processing now and where it's at now compared to, and even when I started really getting serious about it, you know, going back 15 or more years to the in the box kind of recording. It's just come so far. I mean, you know, compare early Waves plugins to what we have now.
It's scary.
It's quite a leap. Yeah.
I had my damn video on the whole time. It wasn't recording, but it's just.
Oh.
Yeah. So like, it was getting all hot.
Oh.
I remember. I got to know Bunny Brunell pretty well.
He and
I both have kids of the same age, so we'd hung out a lot for quite a few years. And I remember he was selling all his rack gear back in 2000 something, and I thought, why is he selling all this shit? Yeah, he knew.
Oh, the computers were.
Yeah, like it was starting to. Oh, it sounds good in the box, you know. And
right.
And I was like, what? You're really better than Lexicon, better than you know. But he was right. I mean, it got to a point where it was all usable. The stuff that's in the box.
Yeah. Right.
Man, what a revolution. You look at a studio, I've taken studio classes at this college, and what a studio looks like. I mean, they kind of have one here that kind of looks like a studio, but nothing but I remember being in when we were kids.
Yeah, well, it was such an investment in not only the board, but then all the outboard gear that you would have to actually properly do a mix. You know?
And like your tubes and your amp, the tape machine, you basically have to be a mechanic too.
Oh, that shit breaks down all the time.
You're aligning it all the time and cleaning it all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, even just the amount of guitars that I have now. Every time I pick one up, there's something wrong with it. I'm like, it was just hanging on the wall. How did it get screwed up? Why isn't it making a sound now? I don't even understand.
True. That's a good one.
But yeah, you have a board. Holy cow. A friend of mine in Nashville has a really nice studio, and he had this beautiful Neve, and he's basically at the level of like an electrical engineer. Like
just
he's a fantastic audio engineer.
Yeah.
But he could pull out one of those channels and solder on it and fix it and put it back. Like, he's one of these superhuman people that has this ability to do this. And he had this Neve that he just held onto forever because it sounded great. But at a certain point, he's like, it's taken too much time. So he upgraded like to a new API or something. He just couldn't deal with it.
You certainly can't, if it's a money thing, you certainly can't compete, you know, with the, on analog with the digital world.
Sure,
production-wise.
Yeah,
I mean, as far as delivering shit.
Yeah, I mean, at home, I have a lot of really great software, but, you know, everything is run through a UA channel strip that I have at home. Because I don't record that. I don't need that much I/O
at home. You
don't
need a bunch of inputs.
Yeah, so, you know, I have this one single-channel universal LA-610. It's an LA-2 compressor plus the 610 preamp.
Yeah.
Everything sounds good through it, basically. But I have another Summit preamp that I use and a couple other compressors. So I have some options, but I don't need that much. But the point being is I don't necessarily rely on the sound going in to be manipulated on its way in by software. You choose to use the hardware going in.
Yes.
After that, then I'll play with it. Yeah.
And in the photography world, it's the same. If you photograph a certain things, they put an aesthetic on there that you're happy with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's way less work on the back end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because in a sense, digital, and it's the same in audio, digital's so wide open that it's overwhelming. Now, what do I do with this sound? Do I make it warm? Do I make it Neve? Do I make it, you know, there's so many things you can do with it.
Right.
Sometimes it's easier to make decisions on the front end.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what I've been doing a lot lately, is just because I think that's maybe another sign of maturity when you're early on and you're like, I don't know how this is going to go. Like, maybe I want this sound, maybe I want that sound. So I'll just record very neutrally and then I'll play with it later. And then you get to a certain point, you're like, I don't want to play with it later. I just want to get it in sounding good.
Trap.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Time's important.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So tell me about this work that you did that I was so, I had the thing on my, I was listening to your music, this guitar orchestra that you're doing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for listening to it. Yeah. I
mean, it's phenomenal.
Thanks.
How did it come about?
So let's see, I had just finished that Polyhedron record that came out last year. So I had just finished that. And I think, so this came from when I was writing some music for Facebook. We would get these prompts, like, you know, the music department wants, they would give us like a list of things. And one time the list came in and it was minimalist type of music. And I thought, well, that's odd. Why do you guys want minimalism? And this is for their sound collection, which they have a collection of, you know, tens of thousands of songs that people can use in their own videos on Instagram or Facebook or whatever. So, so I was like, okay, I'll try doing something kind of minimalistic. And I tried some things, and it reminded me, when I got started doing it, it reminded me of that Steve Reich record, Different Trains. And on that record, the first half of the record is with Kronos Quartet, and the second half is with Pat Metheny, this piece called Electric Counterpoint, which is... which was written for him for playing guitar. And it's a bunch of layered guitars. So I thought, well, I'll try doing maybe something like that and see how it comes out. So I kind of did these, if I look at them now, they're just like really rough versions of what eventually became Terrace. And so that was kind of the first like experiment, like, mm-hmm. okay, I can come up with this kind of phrase-based, minimalistic kind of piece, and it's not terrible. So I was like, okay, so there's
it's really good.
There's something
you're
there
at that point.
It wasn't terrible. So like, okay, and it was fun. Like I was like, this is a different way to compose that I've never done before, because I would just kind of record different phrases on top of each other, and then use Logic basically as a compositional tool to move phrases around in time,
right?
And in a way that my brain wouldn't work in, like. like, it's hard for me to do math. So I can't break up a seven phrase with like a three phrase and figure out where they're going to meet eventually down several, you know, but I can put it down on the logic and I can see where they're going to line up and see if that sounds or feels good. Yeah, you can see it, see the clips on there. And then if it feels right, I'm like, okay, well, that's someplace I wouldn't have gotten to working on my own. Like,
that's interesting.
You know, so I like kind of that process of doing it that way. And then, on the last track that I mixed for that Polyhedron record, there was a track with Eva Batova, this fantastic Czech singer. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I added to it was this little guitar part. And it didn't sound right. And I was like, well, I'll just layer it. And then I'll layer it some more. And I ended up putting, like, I think 35 layers for this really short little, like, four-bar guitar phrase. And finally, I was like, that feels right.
34 layers?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I started layering it and using different guitars, using different mic distances, and then harmonizing it. And I was like, okay, now it's starting to feel like what I wanted there. Because it's a kind of a big, it's a small song. It just has the same, chord progression through the whole thing, which just repeats six times, I think. And then the lyrics repeat three times, but it's a really long melody. And she just sings it three times, and there's a part where she just does improv. But every time there's a section of that chord progression that starts over again, I wanted it to feel like a totally different experience every time. So at one point I had these background singers doing sort of like a Fela Kuti kind of African voice thing, very syncopated kind of voice parts. And then there's another part where all these, again, Fela Kuti kind of saxophone parts come in. And then this is all with Eva singing on top of it. And then bring in some drum parts. And then at the very end, it's like the saxes, the vocals, and then... And at a certain point within that, there's guitar stuff happening. So every section was meant to be different. Anyway, long way of going about saying that I came up with this layering guitar thing.
You're staring at 32.
And that's on top of everything else that was already in the song. But
you sub the 32?
Yeah. I would create in Logic and do these track stacks.
Yeah. And love track stacks.
Yeah. It's a nice, rather than just creating a new auxiliary bus. It's a nice way to kind of organize them just because you can make
them. For
your
brain.
Yeah, exactly. It does. Because otherwise you're looking at all these tracks, but you can just hit the disclosure triangle and they disappear into a folder.
I was
like, oh, this is great.
I love it.
Yeah. So I had those two things in my mind. And then I started thinking, I should maybe play with that layering thing.
You liked it.
Yeah, I liked
it. What did you like about it?
I liked trying to create the feeling of a lot of players in a room, which is something that I got from that Pat Metheny record. And just if I just think about it, well, now I've listened to it a lot since I finished my record, but in the past, I remember thinking about that record, which I used to listen to a lot. And for some reason, I remember it being bigger than it was. If you listen to it now, you don't hear more than maybe a dozen or 14 guitar tracks at any time. Mm-hmm. But I remember it feeling bigger. And a lot of that is because of Reich's writing. He would do this. He would do some things in the writing with phasing and whatnot that would kind of make it feel a little bit bigger. And so I like the idea of trying to create the sound of a lot of guitars doing the same part in a physical space. It created kind of a bigger physical sound. Mm. You know, if you had taken 30 guitar players and put them in a room, you could get a sound, but it would be different than what I was doing. But I was trying to create what that sound might sound like in your head.
The concept of that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Because if you went into a room and did that with 30 guitar players, you'd just probably have a stereo, maybe a couple stereo pairs.
You look at them as one instrument as opposed to...
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And I knew I wanted to mix this in Atmos, so I wanted a little bit of that separation, so it would feel like as you turn your head around
you're gonna get the mix,
you'll get a little bit of
a
different...
thing happens. Yeah, okay. You couldn't do that with just two mics.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So... So, you know, that's not to say that I wouldn't like to record with 30 guitar players in a room and have that stereo pair, because that's really good for certain things. Mm-hmm. There are certain parts of some of those arrangements that would sound great for that.
Right.
But then there's a lot of parts where we want that separation too. Mm-hmm. So in an ideal world, I'd be able to do both.
Right.
You know. I had a break from, I actually took a leave of absence from work, mm-hmm. and just started work on the record.
That's cool.
And because I could.
Because you were like, okay. And you just felt like it was something you wanted to do.
Yeah. And the other thing about this record too was, every piece was about someone who I'd known who had passed away.
Oh,
recently.
I didn't know this.
Okay, yeah. So, wow. In a really short amount of time, a lot of people I knew pretty well all passed away, like within 3, 4, 5 years. And there was one spell where 3 or 4 people kind of, in less than a year, died. Mm. And you always imagine that when something like that happens, you're going to have this time to process it. Like, at least I did. I thought, well, you know, there'll be time to grieve, and you'll figure it out, and you know what this feels like. You need to absorb it, and you, like, I don't know what it is. It's like this feeling of you have to honor their memory somehow, mm-hmm. and. I didn't know what that meant. I still don't know exactly what it means, mm-hmm. but it just didn't feel like I had time to do that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so one of these people was my dad. One of these people was Hardy Fox, who was in the residence, and really was one of the people that believed in me early on. Like, I think Chuck was one of those people too, mm-hmm. but Hardy was another person. Mm. And
so like a mentor.
Yeah. Like if Hardy hadn't been encouraging, because he was the one I was in touch with about doing that residence tribute record.
The first one?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then when I moved to the Bay Area, like, he basically helped me, like, work for them, work for Ralph America. Like, he believed in me. And I often think, where would I be if he hadn't believed in me? Like,
right.
if he had not right. embraced me and just kind of blew me off as some other dumb fan, you know? Like,
he saw something.
Yeah. There was something there. So, I got to honor that, you know? And that person and what that relationship meant, you know? And I didn't really know how to approach it. And it sounds really cheesy to think, well, I'll just write a song about it.
Why is that cheesy?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like a lot of people maybe just, well, this is about a song about someone that died. And I don't know. It seems a little hackneyed maybe just, even though people are probably very, very earnest about it. I think there's something maudlin about that as well at the same
really,
time, you know?
I think that anything that would come out of you regarding somebody that meant that to you would be sweet and beautiful.
Well, that was what I hoped for. And I wanted to make something that honored this time we had together, you know? And whether that turned out to be something that was going to be good for releasing, I wasn't really thinking about it. It was more like, it was almost like the process of doing these repetitive phrases over and over again and recording them. And every time I did, I was really thinking about this person for each one of those. I knew whose song I was doing when I wrote them. And so it was sort of this meditative.
I was going to say, it's almost like a chant.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, it was like this kind of mantra.
Right.
Musical mantra. And so when I would record them, I was thinking about this person a lot and thinking about, you know, memories that we had together and things like that. And that seemed to be like an important part of that process of dealing with the memory of
that's
that person.
Crazy.
And for me, it was like what I had to do, you know.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's what I heard.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
You never told me that, but there's something about it. I actually called you up.
I never
call you up, and and I, you know, just because I always think you're busy or whatever. And,
right.
But it was something about that work that I was like, man, this is really good.
Oh, thanks. I mean, it meant a lot to get your call and just to hear that it moved you. Because, you know, you put that kind of thing out there. Like I said, I haven't been thinking about what kind of response it would have. I just thought, well, this seems like a beautiful thing, and I want to honor these people. I didn't really. I've had a surprising response to it. Everyone who's reached out and told me that, you know, they didn't have to, like you. You know, they didn't have to get a hold of me. But I've had some people, you know, get back to me and they're like, yeah, that was really, you know, I really enjoyed this. Even people who like electronic music and things like that, you know, they listen to EDM or whatever, they're like, this kind of has that quality, but it's not synths, you know.
That, it does. And you know, some people don't know that I remember going, I bounce around this podcast, you know, when I had maybe it was Wackerman's sampler in my house, I can't remember, but you came over and you did some stuff where you had a little LL Cool J moment where you sampled.
Oh, I remember that.
What was it? It was like something about the beat. And who was that talking?
Well, I know.
It's all about the beat. Jack Kerouac, was it Kerouac or somebody?
I remember sampling some. I think
some spoken language stuff and some James Brown and.
Yeah, and I think we sampled that "Mama Said Knock You Out" beat and some of that stuff.
It was fun.
Yeah, but I love sampling. I mean, I think sampling is wonderful. And
so even though you play that all acoustically, I mean, you're not prejudiced against, you know, music is music, right? I mean,
oh yeah, for sure, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I love samplers and things you can do with them. So, and you know, I have almost as many synths in my room as I do guitars. So, yeah.
You know, that's the big thing now in college, if you're a musician, right? Did you know that?
What's that?
Well, if you go to Berklee School of Music, that's the hot piece of paper is synthesis.
Yeah. A friend of mine is one of the professors there, Michael Bierla. And when we were back east last summer, and I wanted to connect him with my wife because she runs the after-school music program, Bay Area Music Project, and sometimes they're looking for people to staff up her music program, so we want to make a connection with Berklee School of Music, and so I wanted her to meet him. And then he took us on tour of the new stuff and the new building at in the electronic music section, and they've got amazing setup now for... Right. They've got... So, we went in the modular synth room where they've got, I think, about five or six different identical modular synth setups.
Killer.
For people to learn modular synthesis.
Attack, decay, release.
Yeah. And they're all plugged into the same system, and whoever the teacher is can, you know, can change the mixer so that they're hearing different people's music, or all those people can collaborate together. It's pretty cool. It's a pretty cool setup. But they even have like a whole setup for people to learn how to create circuits and electrical designs for synths or whatever.
Physically do that.
Yeah, they have a whole soldering room and everything for people to learn that. And some really interesting stuff going on there with synths.
Well, that brings me to the last question.
Yeah.
Because I have to do that because you and I will talk until the sun goes down.
I know.
Which is, you know, what are your thoughts on AI?
Oh.
Have you played with it at all? What are your thoughts on it?
I have. I have played with the DALL-E image thing. And I actually use it because I do this little YouTube series of called Ghost Notes, where I just talk about stuff that's interesting.
Oh, I gotta watch that. Okay. Cool.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Cool.
Ghost Notes.
Ghost Notes. Okay, it's on YouTube. That. Yeah. It's. Yeah.
I'll subscribe to that.
I just cover things that are about mixing or about the creative process.
Cool.
Things that I think are interesting. I don't cover new gear. Like, there's so many people that do that.
Oh, that's a job in itself.
That's totally a job in itself. Yeah. And I don't think I'd bring anything interesting to that. So I just talk about the things that I think maybe someone will find interesting. So all the cover images for that series, whatever the topic is, I'll plug a phrase into DALL-E and try and get some kind of image out of it.
And does it work every time, or what's that process?
Yeah, it doesn't work every time.
Yeah, it doesn't, does it?
Yeah.
I do stuff with AI and it's not perfect yet. But you could see how it could.
Yeah.
Pretty damn close.
I saw a hilarious phrase the other day, it was aimed at graphic designers or artists, and says, for AI to work, the client actually has to know what they want, so we're good. We've got nothing to worry about. Because famously, clients never know what the hell they want.
But it is astounding. Like if you look at, because I know you're a literary major.
Yeah.
If you take AI and you say make a caption for me about creativity, daily creativity. 59-year-old man playing the drums. You bullet point it.
Yeah.
It gets. At least one of the paragraphs that it spits out is pretty fucking good.
Yeah, I know. I haven't used ChatGPT as much, but I did use it for... I was doing an... I decided to make an audio ad for Spotify. And I didn't want to write the copy. I'm like, this is hard. So I just gave a few prompts into ChatGPT to give me some copy. It was too flowery and a little bit silly, but it did give me something quickly that I could
just... Couldn't you say to it, like, something more...
I did. Okay. Yeah, I did do that. We whittled it down a little bit. Yeah. And then I just edited a little bit. It took a lot of the initial creative lift for writing.
The word vomit, right?
Yeah.
Aspect.
Yeah, because I didn't want to spend that much time on it. I was just like, okay, maybe this will work for this. So my wife is using it for grants, for her grant writing. It helps. She can put in a prompt.
It gets you started.
And she can get started. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's the hardest part with writing grants, you know. Mm-hmm. So I have used it a little bit. I am... quite concerned about what it's going to do, especially to library music and that whole industry.
I heard that it's going to kill that.
Yeah.
That's what I heard.
I mean, if you think about, you know, I have friends that have huge libraries of well-recorded, beautiful-sounding library music with aesthetics and just, like, they've thought deeply about this kind of thing and the use cases and whatnot and... put a lot of art and craft into it, and just to watch that kind of effort be lost, I think it's going to affect that industry first. And, you know, for anyone who doesn't know what that is, it's just, you know, if, let's say a small TV show, public TV wants some music for something, and they just want to pay a license real quickly online, they can pay $100 and use this piece for this piece. Use it for a video that they post online or whatever, whatever that might be. And then that just scales up from there to a series or whatever. Interestingly enough, the Curb Your Enthusiasm theme is from library music.
Oh, okay.
So is the music from Sunny, Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Those are straight library tracks they
Killer.
Just pulled.
Right.
Those are a couple of famous ones. But I'm worried about that industry because that a lot of engineers and composers and musicians make money doing that. And, that could conceivably really go away. I mean, I can see maybe it's not going to affect a lot of those people if AI is just making chill electronic music.
Like, but it's not. I mean, I heard that people believe that Spotify will get rid of the studio and the musician, and Spotify will just generate music.
Well, I wonder if that's their goal. They have banned a lot of these AI labels now. They just did that recently, the last couple of weeks. Because what's happening is, if you just get a bunch of people flooding Spotify with AI-generated music, no one's going to find anything.
That stresses their... Oh, so it dilutes...
It dilutes their whole product in a pretty damaging way, I think. Because...
Okay.
That'll fuck up their algorithms and everything and point people to the right kind of music. And you know, people can put whatever they want as far as their descriptors of the types of genres, and it could really foul things up, you know.
Right.
Because the thing that Spotify and everyone else counts on for making their algorithms work is that artists want to develop themselves as that artist, the brand of that artist.
Yes.
And if you've just got thousands of bots
that
don't
noise.
Care about any of that, it just completely throws a monkey wrench into the whole thing.
I heard that, to speak to that a little bit, I heard that, is it Drake? Was that the famous story about the AI where somebody they created a new song for this artist. I think his name's Drake. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I think you're right. They were copying a Drake.
And
song.
They literally used just the phonetics of his voice. They didn't have him go and record it.
Right.
And they put it on Spotify and everything, and it began to rise.
Yep.
And then that person said, hey, this is an AI thing.
Yeah.
And then the part that was really sort of scary was that a lot of Drake fans were like, well, I kind of liked it.
Yeah, right.
So they didn't need Drake.
That's right.
They didn't need the engineers. They didn't need the musicians.
Right.
They like what the robot made. How's that going to get worse? Like, the robot's not going to get worse at making pop music.
Well, it did take somebody to collect those things and put them together yes. in an aesthetic way. That artist, David Guetta, I think is how you say his name, the electronic music
okay.
guy, for one of his shows in the last couple months, he had done something similar where he put in a prompt to write lyrics like Tupac. He got a voice, an AI voice, to sound like Eminem, to rap to the Tupac lyrics
yeah.
at a tempo that he designated. And then he recorded it and added some stuff where and played it at the beginning of one of his shows, and people thought it was Eminem doing something new with David Guetta. And
right.
But he didn't say anything. I don't think at the show he said, by the way, that was AI.
He didn't
AI.
Reveal that.
He just played it at the beginning of his set, and people freaked out.
Right.
And then later revealed what it was.
Wow. What do you think about that?
Well, overall, I just can't help but think about Terminator, you know?
Yeah. I mean, whoever owns ChatGPT, did you see that? I saw this footage. He was literally like before some government body begging for them to regulate
yeah,
him.
Yeah, yeah.
Why would he do that?
That's the same thing Facebook's been asking for years, because they keep getting fined. They're like, well, regulate us. Give us some.
Also, it's for money, because they're afraid it'll protect them in some sense.
I think that might be part of it. Okay. And I think that's also to help competition, too, to try okay. and quell, let's set the guardrails on this.
Okay.
So we know how far this stuff can go, because it can go pretty far, and we better right. get some regulations on this. And so I think that's where some of that comes from. But yeah, I can't help but think that it's like, as artists, I think we look at the potential of what this can do. Like, how can this help us? Like, yeah, I can write copy real quick for my
today
ad.
It can assist you.
Yeah, today yes. it can assist you. But, yeah. you know, I don't know the effect of what it's going to do to jobs, especially for artists. That worries me. But what's I think is bigger concern is we already have trouble figuring out what's real and not real with fake news and
yes.
and the internet. And
yes.
this is already a huge problem. How far are we away from just AI deciding what the news is going to be and then
yes.
spreading that everywhere? I mean, I'm not necessarily thinking of, you know, AI becoming self-aware.
It's what humans will do with it.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. It seems like it's going to be one more step to make it easier to manipulate people.
It's like a little digital army.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
For propaganda for...
Right.
Right.
Propaganda is like a huge boon to propaganda.
Right, yeah. I mean, you can literally... You don't need to be... You can be very prominent with very little.
Yeah, right, right.
Relentless.
So, yeah, I think overall I'm skeptical and concerned. I like the potential of what it could do for creative people, but I think that's too big of a price, probably.
Right.
You know, I think we're going to be, depending on how this goes, we might be very sorry that this is taken off.
And do you think it's something we can put back in the box?
That's a great question. I don't know. I mean, it's open source, so the chances of that are probably pretty slim.
Right. If it's useful, if it puts money in people's pockets or gives them, well, if it gives people power, it'll exist.
Yeah, right, probably. Right, right. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's certainly interesting and in a certain sense, it's fun to play around with.
Today.
Yeah.
But we know that it could be something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It could be a bad thing.
Yeah. It's going to be something. I mean, it's to see where this goes is going to be an interesting, possibly dangerous ride. But it's like, like you say, we can't really stop it, though. This train has taken off.
It's taken off.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for talking.
Yeah.
You know, let's do this every 40 years, okay?
You got it. Well, we'll just have the bots do it for us in 40 years.
That's true. It'll take your brain the way you think, mine. yeah. our voices, and it'll just do podcasts for
you. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That should be entertaining.
Well, I'll see you on one of those.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks. Thanks, Trent. Thank you.